underwriting support for the Book Show podcast on WAMC.org comes from Northshire Bookstore, Manchester Center, Vermont, and Saratoga Springs, New York. An independent bookstore offering books, author events, gifts for children and adults, and more. Northshire.com. And from the College of St. Rose, Albany, New York, offering a new Bachelor of Science degree in Public Health with a focus on social, physical, and behavioral sciences. strose.edu.
Welcome to The Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. Described by Time Magazine as one of the most fun people in show business, Alan Cumming is an award-winning actor, artist, writer, activist, and photographer. He's won an Olivier Award for his work on the London stage and a Tony for his work on Broadway. He's appeared in all 7 seasons of CBS's The Good Wife, for which he received multiple Emmy and Golden Globe nominations. In his new book, You Gotta Get Bigger Dreams, he shares entertaining real-life stories of late-night parties, backstage anecdotes, life in L.A. and New York, travels with Charlie-like cross-country road trips with his dog, Honey, and poignant memories of his life, loves, family, fellow actors, and friends. He's also the author of the novel Tommy's Tale and the New York Times best-selling memoir Not My Father's Son. His new book is You Gotta Get Bigger Dreams. Before a live audience at the Fisher Center for Performing Arts on the campus of Bard College, it's a great pleasure to welcome Alan Cumming to this week's book show. My God, you're a real person.
No, I'm not.
When you put together a book like this, what do you hope the reader gets out of the book and ultimately knows about you at its conclusion?
In a funny way, I sort of hope that the reader will realize things that I've realized about myself, which is that I'm an outsider. I'm an outsider in this country, obviously, and I'm also now an outsider in my own country because I spent so much of my adult life away from it. But that's a place that I actually really, you know, relish. And I think it's a really great place to be as an artist because you have a perspective on things that is really healthy. So in a way, this book is me standing back and saying to the reader, look at this. And I'm actually in the thing that I'm kind of marveling at the same time. So I think it's actually, that's what I hope the reader will be able to see me as an insider and an outsider. And also, you learn more about me than you ever would wish to know.
We'll get to that in a moment.
You see more of me than you'd ever wish to know, too.
Get to that, too. It is interesting, though, because it seems as though a lot of people, there is a sense of what you want to share, what you don't want to share. You still have that wonderment, amazement, relish is the word I think you used a moment ago, of the things around you. You are far from jaded.
Yes, I am, I think. I hope so. I mean, I think it's partly because I've had a funny life. I didn't come to this country until I was 30. So I had a whole other, whole other existence. So I came to it as a grown man and as, an adult and with a whole career and life. Being in the position I am now and doing what I do is so completely surprising. And I mean, and yet at the same time, it's not. It's kind of just my life. It's just what happens. Yeah, I feel I've tumbled through life. And so it's not like I woke up one day and here I am, Alan Cumming. But at the same time, I think because I didn't grow up in this country and I certainly didn't grow up in a sort of showbiz environment, that I have this healthy perspective on it. And I think that's, and also I'm a kind of person that as I detailed in my last book, I had a lot of problems in my childhood. It was a very dark time. So I have access in my life and my work to great darkness and despair, I suppose. But I choose to stand in the light. And I think that's a really great option to have. And so I do have joy.
In preparation for this, I reread your last book. And I was thinking, well, there obviously two very different projects. I would think for you that this would just be joyous in writing, just fun, right? You're just writing it for fun.
Yeah, I mean, I think all writing should be fun. But I wrote this as a funny way, though, this was the book I meant to write before not my father's son. Because really, I mean, really what it is, I mean, I didn't just sort of think, oh, I'll write this thing for fun. I wanted to write more about my life. I realized I have this kind of crazy life. There's a story in the book called I'm Writing This Because Gore Vidal Told Me To. Yes. And I wanted to call the book that, but they wouldn't let me. And so it wouldn't fit on the spine.
Oh, okay.
And
all right.
I did. I have done what Gore Vidal told me. I spent a weekend with him in Ravello in Italy about 15 years ago, and he told me that I should write about my life and analyze it, and analyze the people that I meet. So in a way, this book I started off writing these stories, and actually the first one I wrote was about that weekend with Gore, and I sort of think he's right. I have a very fascinating life, and I wanted to share it with people, and I wanted to, again, marvel at it from the outside as well as being a player in the narrative. So I was writing those stories, and I thought, I do want to write about my life. And then, of course, in 2010, all these things happened to me that made me write my last book. So it kind of went on hold. So now I've come back to, I went back to these stories and this idea of a series of essays, and then by then I actually thought it would be a better way to do it would be to include photographs, and you know, if I want to give people literal snapshots, I mean that's what these are—they're literary snapshots, I suppose.
And I want to talk to you about the photography in a moment. When you say analyze, you're analyzing people, you're analyzing yourself, you're analyzing the situations that you're in at any given time.
Yeah, and I think it's important. I mean, I don't just want—I mean, all my stories are, you know, I hope I don't just go like, oh, well, I went to this party and I met this person. There's something about why I want to write about that. You know, like with the Gore story, I write about how sad I was about the fact that he could never admit to having loved, and the fact that I didn't believe him either. I sort of think I want to write about situations I'm in, but I want to like learn something from it and communicate something about them that is not, that's beyond just, oh, here's a fun party.
I ask this question a lot, and sometimes it can be confusing. But I'm interested in when you're writing, is that the analysis that you are writing to work through and fully understand, or have you worked that through in your mind that allows you to then write?
I think there's three stages of that process. For me, anyway, I've realized that there's a stage where you think, okay, I'm going to write this because I want to write this because of blah. Right. And then during the course of writing, you think, oh, I see, the reason I'm writing this is completely different. And then the book comes out and people relate to it and you engage with people about it. And then you think, oh, God, I never thought of this. So there's different stages. Like the third stage of this book is that I realize this book is a love letter to my dog. And that it's time for me to let go of her, but to celebrate her as I let go. That's what I've realized. That's what's been amazing about taking this out on the road and talking to people. That's what this book was for.
I knew I was doing the interview with you, and then they sent me the book, and I'm reading along, and I'm making notes, and I get to this, and you're talking about, this is kind of a day-to-day, this is Travels with Honey, actually. This is from that chapter, and you say, so I turned over to good old NPR, which I had abandoned earlier because they were having one of their fundraising drives.
I knew you were going to read this bit. I just knew this was going to come out. Every NPR station I've been on to talk about this book brings this up. But please go ahead.
And Casey Flintoff had actually done an impersonation of Winston Churchill. I didn't get the connection unless, unbeknownst to me, Churchill also took to the airwaves to recruit supporters by boring them into submission. There is truly nothing more annoying than those swatty NPR types trying to convince us what a good conversationalist Terry Gross is. We know she's amazing. Okay, and then I'm reading it. I'm chuckling. I find this all very funny. And then it says, although, side note, the last time I was on, Terry did spend an inordinate amount of time talking about my sexuality and then my armpits.
That's true.
It felt as though, if I squinted, the NPR acronym had morphed into TMZ. So,
welcome to America.
So then I thought two things. One, I guess I can understand why Terry, and I hadn't heard the interview, and then I thought, well, I can understand why Terry would ask you questions about your sexuality,
yeah.
although I can't imagine why she would make them the entire focal point of the interview. And then I'm thinking, well, so why is she interested in your armpits? And I thought, well, that's odd, isn't it?
Yes.
Okay. All right. So we're all together on that.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah. All right. Good. So initially I was worried, and then after reading and finishing the book, and then having reread your other book, I said, okay, I don't really have any questions about either of those subjects for you. I felt much better.
Oh, great.
Yes.
Well, there's nothing else to talk about then.
Okay.
Is there?
No. Well.
Can I just say though, I'm so ashamed. There's a mistake. It says Casey Flintoff instead of Corey Flintoff, and I can't believe it. So in the next edition, it's going to change. I apologize to Corey Flintoff.
I thought they had a relative. I didn't know. I knew he had like gone to Russia or something, so I wasn't sure exactly.
No, he's in Russia now, isn't he? Yeah.
I will.
He'll never hear of this.
I won't.
But can I just say, like, I do think there must be a more efficient way to raise money for NPR than because, don't you think, those days when you turn and you think, oh God, it's the fun drive thing, and they're gonna just, like, it's like a war of attrition. They just wear you down into like getting a NPR tote. And my favorite ever headline in The Onion was Chardonnay vomited into NPR tote. And I was like, I know those parties. I completely know those people. But I do think, but anyway, blah, blah. Obviously, NPR is a fabulous thing, and I love it. And I, you know, was just doing a little bit of fun. But
yes,
she did talk about my armpits a lot.
Or we won't talk about your armpits. Although here, there's a chest hair photo, but that isn't you. You do talk about the fact that you wish you had chest hair.
I really crave chest hair, yes, yes. That's my friend Siddhartha, and there's a little sort of essay about chest hair, and I do feel like it's one of those things that I like chest hair and I like boobs. I think, you know, I like sort of real things in
yes.
bodies. I think it's good to be hairy. I think it's good to be curvy. I think it's good to have, you know, proper sexual characteristics and secondary sexual characteristics. And I'm very hairy everywhere else apart from my chest, and it really pisses me off.
But you get.
I don't have boobs either.
No. But you get revenge, you get to write about it.
Yeah, I guess. And also once, I was talking about this the other day because I was in London and people were asking me, when I did the Spice Girls film, I had a chest wig. Because I was...
Really?
Yeah, because I was trying to look like that English documentary maker, you know, Nick Broomfield. Thank you very much. And because I was playing a documentary maker in the Spice Girls film, because I saw the Spice Girls last week, that's why I'm... two of them, anyway. And in the film, I played a documentary maker, and I wanted to, you know, as a homage to Nick Broomfield, so I had a hairy chest wig, and it was really itchy. And so at lunchtime, you know, if you have wigs on films, and you have to go after at the end of lunchtime, you have to go 10 minutes early into hair and makeup, and they fiddle with you. And so it's 10 minutes less sleeping time that you can have at lunchtime. So I would take the thing off, and then I have to go in for 10 minutes, and they'd glue it back on. And so then I started to say, oh, I'm not going to take it off for lunch. I'm not going to take it off. So I don't need to go. I can have 10 minutes extra. And I would take it off. And then I'd put it on myself. And so in the Spice Girls film, my chest wig moves all over my neck like that.
Now we'll have to go
yes.
watch it again, right?
That is an inducement to watch the
yes.
Spice Girls film.
I'm hoping you will read us a section because I want to talk about photography as an essential element of this book. And you're, of course, anyone who follows you on Twitter or follows you on Instagram certainly knows that you love a good selfie.
Yes.
But you also, as you point out in the book, without taking too much credit here, that this is something that you have been doing for a very, very long time, much well before we got addicted to these things.
Yeah. So here we go. There's a section called Mandatory Selfies, and there's lots and lots of pictures in the book that are not selfies, but there's a big section that are, and I write this. I don't want to be that guy, but I've been taking selfies since the 1980s, people. Not that that's really a big deal, because let's face it, they're not a great achievement in the grand scheme of things. And all I was doing was turning a camera and eventually a phone around so the lens faced me and whoever else was in the picture, rather than pointing it out to the world. And that does not require a degree in brain surgery. But I'm just saying, I was having to accurately self-frame long before the selfie button was around. Okay, kids? Thank you.
Now, Alan Cumming is our guest. The name of the book is You Gotta Get Bigger Dreams. Now, I do hope that you will read another section in the book, which is early on in the book, where you write, and I think the first time I met you was in a lobby of seeing, I had seen you on stage many times, but to actually meet you was, you were in the lobby and you had just seen Fun Home. Was that the year that you hosted
the Tonys? Yes.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And you had these wonderful bright yellow Crocs on, and I thought, man, you're rocking those. That you just looked great. So but I didn't realize how
actually they were orange, and this is that one of them on this picture.
Yes.
That's them. That's the actual
one. Oh, that's the actual ones.
That's one of the one. That's my shoe, and that's it's a picture of a Croc.
On a police line.
There's a fallen over police line. It says, police line, do not cross. And my croc is crossing it. So this is a section called Crocs. I am fascinated by Crocs. Not just the shoes themselves, but more the way somehow society has deemed it okay for everyone to think and then voice openly that they are ugly. I suppose I worry about the sheep-like following of any belief. Religion and politics, to name but two, are topics to which people have fierce allegiances that they will unflinchingly defend. Yet often, these don't stand up to much scrutiny, if indeed much scrutiny is ever entertained. Crocs are much the same. You need only drop the very name in some quarters and people will spew virulent hatred. I find it frightening. I think it's a form of fascism. We all feel comfortable in our collective hatred of the other. Hello, welcome to this election, ladies and gentlemen. But in this case, it's about colorful rubber shoes. Come on, people. Once I was in Hawaii making the film The Tempest. I wore my Crocs all the time because they are comfortable and you can go in and out of the water with them, and I like them. I really, really like them. I like that they are big and clumpy and fun and bold, and therefore the antithesis of what we are conditioned to believe we should wear on our feet, especially when we are a middle-aged man. Whenever we went to a new location for the film, we would be given a blessing ceremony. The cast and crew would all gather to watch the kahu, ask the spirits to wish us well, and then we'd have a few beers. One night, I was chatting to Helen Mirren, who was playing Prospera. It's normally Prospero, but they made her a woman in our version. And out of nowhere, she looked down towards my feet and said, I think Crocs are ugly. I was slightly taken aback. Oh, I said, well, you know what, Helen? Sometimes I think what people are wearing is ugly, but I just use my inside voice. She thought about that for a moment and then replied, yes, I see what you mean, but I still think they're ugly. Okay, I said, let's move on, shall we? A few weeks later, I was returning from my first day back on set after a break home in New York City. I was driven through a vast forest of short, windswept trees, and finally we came out onto a remote volcanic wasteland. There were the familiar trailers and the hustle and bustle that is a film set gearing up for the day. As I got out of the car, I heard a familiar voice call my name. It was Helen. She came running around the corner of the makeup truck to greet me. Look, Alan, look, she cried. She pointed down to her feet and to a pair of bright pink Crocs. Helen, I laughed. You've come over to the other side. Yes, she said, like a little girl who'd just been given a puppy. I was wearing flip-flops, but my feet got so sore on all the rocks, and so I tried on some Crocs, and they're so comfortable, and now I've got three different pairs. You were a hater, and now you're a lover, said I, happy that I had one more convert, not just to colorful rubber shoes, but to freedom and tolerance and fun.
Alan Cumming, reading from his new book, You Gotta Get Bigger Dreams, My Life in Stories and Pictures. Were there things that you left out? Were there things that you said, yeah, okay, maybe that is, I don't want to include that for a mass audience?
Do you mean why? Because they're too personal or something?
Yes. Or just you thought, maybe I don't want that.
Oh, well, there's some photos I didn't include because of that, definitely, yes. But, I mean, no, I don't think I write something and then think, oh, I don't want people to read that. You know, if I'm right. writing a story, I think it's like, you know, I expect that I don't really write things that I don't want people to read.
You want them to know about you?
Well, I just think the act of writing is a form of performance in a way. I don't write just for no one to read it. I when I'm writing something, I'm thinking people are going to read this. You know, I think that's that is the performer in me. I don't take journals and things like that.
In reading this book and certainly in your last book, mm-hmm. they're beautifully written. They're beautifully written books, which made me wonder, are there times then when you get a script and you look at it and say, oh man, this is awful?
Oh, all the time.
Yeah.
Yeah. But that's not just because I'm a writer. That's because, you know, I mean, you know, you don't have to be a writer to think that something's awfully written.
No, but I would think you could also see where it could be improved, where it could be things
oh,
could
yes.
change.
Yes, I know, and you know, there's a sort of a sliding scale of that. Like, there's scripts I get and think, wow, this is amazing, I really, you know. And then there's the scripts I get more so, actually, where I think, oh, this is really good, there's some great things here, but it could do with blah, 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 blah being fixed. And I would then, you know, if I wanted to pursue it, I would say that. And people are very, you know, mostly very willing to hear that. And then there's ones you just think, oh, this is just never gonna, no. It's not gonna happen, ever. And also, you know, I think that you have to choose your battles in life as well as in art.
But even if, so you can go from, let's say, Shakespeare and working in Titus to being in the Flintstones movie.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, the writing is a little different.
Well, the subject matter is a little different,
yes.
First of all.
But perhaps the quality, right? The quality of the writing? But that's okay.
Well, you know, I don't really like this tone that you've got right now, John. obviously, you know, yes, duh. But I think, actually, there's a sort of, you know, yeah, you know what? Nothing is going to be on the same par as Shakespeare except
right.
for the Shakespeare plays, you know? So let's leave that one. But I do find there's a sort of a weird, it's not inverted snobbery, but there's a snobbery about, I find, that American people tend to have. It doesn't happen so much in Britain, that if you're someone like me who does a wide eclectic range of things, and sometimes you do very, you know, high, what you perceive as high-end arty things like a Shakespeare film or a Shakespeare play, mm-hmm. and then you go and do something very commercial, that there's somehow that doesn't quite elide properly in your artistic psyches. It doesn't sit with you well. You think there's something wrong. And I think, you know, people are allowed and able, and it's an imperative, actually, for me anyway, in the life that I want to have, to do, if I want to do like a Tempest or a Titus or an Any Day Now, these films I've done, I've got to do a Flintstones every now and then, or a Smurfs, in order to finance that and to finance the life I want to lead, to be able to do the things that I do. So I think there's this kind of funny thing, there's this sort of unspoken kind of air that I find annoying in American culture, that you feel that if you've done something really great and proper and, you know, arty-farty, that you in some way you're going to be slumming it to do other things like that. And for me, maybe it's just me, but I really enjoy doing trashy things sometimes. Like, you know, like as a person, I really enjoy reading, you know, like right now I'm in this, I've been on tour, I've got these great books. I've got Neil Gaiman's new book, I've got Margaret Atwood's new book last week, signed by Margaret Atwood.
Oh, very
marvelous.
Good.
And then I'm very excited about that, but I've also got Hello Magazine. I can't wait to read about the royal family of Holland. And I think, you know, we can't, I just think we would be, I think we should all be a little more eclectic in our tastes and eclectic in the message we put out to the world.
You Gotta Get Bigger Dreams by Alan Cumming. It is published by Rizzoli. Helen, what a great pleasure to have you before this audience and on the stage. And thank you so much for being on the program.
My pleasure. Thank you very
pleasure.
Much.
We enjoy hearing from our listeners about the show. You can email us at book@wamc.org, and you can listen again to this or find past book shows via podcast or online at wamc.org. Sarah LeDuc produces our program in partnership with Oblong Books, oblongbooks.com. This edition was recorded before a live audience at the Fisher Center for the Performing Arts on the campus of Bard College in Annandale on Hudson, New York. Bookmark us for next week, and thanks for listening for The Book Show. I'm Joe Donahue.